In our new series, World War II's Greatest Battles, we chart five pivotal moments that shaped the course of the conflict with military historian James Holland. New episodes drop every Thursday on the History Extra podcast.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
After the holidays, a little cash goes a long way. The Chime checking account has tons of benefits to help, like fee-free overdraft up to $200 for eligible members, no monthly fees, and thousands of fee-free ATMs. You can even get paid up to 2 days early with direct deposit. Sign up for Chime today at chime.com/goals24.
Banking services and debit card provided by the Bancorp Bank N.A. or Stride Bank N.A. members FDIC. Spot me eligibility requirements and overdraft limits apply. Out-of-network ATM withdrawal fees may apply. Access to direct deposits up to 2 days early depends on the timing of the submission of the payment file from the payer.
This episode is brought to you by Amazon Prime. You know Amazon Prime is not just a shipping subscription, right? It's got everything, including streaming TV and movies on Prime Video. And of course, Prime's fast, free shipping. Go from watching your favorite shows to getting your favorite things. Whatever you're into, it's on Prime. Visit Amazon.com/Prime to get more out of whatever you're into.
Welcome to the History Extra podcast. Fascinating historical conversations from BBC History Magazine and BBC History Revealed. Throughout its 92-year history, the FIFA Men's World Cup has delivered its fair share of iconic moments. From the dazzling exploits of Pelé and Johan Cruyff to Maradona's Hand of God, it's a tournament with a rich and often controversial history, which can often tell us about changes in politics and society over the 20th century, as well as just football. On the eve of this year's World Cup in Qatar, John Balcombe caught up with the sports historian Professor Matthew Taylor, who answered listener questions about the origins of the tournament, its relationship with politics, and its overall impact on the beautiful game.
To kick off, as it were, I want to go back well over 100 years, long before the very first World Cup. When was the first international football match actually played?
Well, I think most records would show that it's a game that took place in 1872 between Scotland and England. So it took place at the West of Scotland Cricket Ground in Glasgow. Not the most exciting match, probably, because it was a 0-0 draw. But, you know, reasonably popular, about 4,000 people attended. There were a few kind of unofficial matches which took place before that. They're sometimes called the Alcock Internationals, which took place in London. But they were basically organised by members of the English FA, and they involved English players against Scots who lived in London. So they weren't representative matches right. In the same way as we understand them. So that's the game that we would normally kind of say was the first international match. But then, you know, over time you had, you know, the first matches between, for instance, Austria and Hungary, two of the big kind of early footballing powerhouses the early 20th century, kind of both part of the same empire, of course, at the time. And Uruguay and Argentina played around 1902. So you then began to have, you know, lots of teams kind of entering the fray in terms of international football, I suppose.
Yeah. And who actually came up with the idea of hosting like an international tournament then?
There were lots of kind of attempts and ideas. I suppose we could say that it came out of that first Scotland-England game, was the first international tournament of sorts, what we, I suppose, call the Home International Championships. But at the time, it was called the British International Championship. So certainly they thought it was international. And that lasted from about 1883 for pretty much 100 years to the 1980s. And then you had lots of tournaments, kind of club-based tournaments, a number of them kind of based in Italy. There was an interesting tournament called the Chiasso Cup, which was based in Switzerland, which actually apparently included the first derby match between the two Milanese sides. So AC Milan and Inter Milan played their first match in Switzerland. And you had the Thomas Lipton Trophy, which is famously won by the amateur side West Auckland against a number of, took place in Turin, Italian, Swiss and German teams. And sometimes that's regarded in Britain and certainly parts of the Northeast as the kind of first world championship. But the actual idea for the World Cup as it developed was right there at the birth of FIFA, the governing body of football, when they were established in 1904. And one of their kind of main aims was to create an international tournament. So there were plans within a few years. The idea was to create a 16-nation international tournament. It didn't get off the ground because of finances and other things. And kind of then what happened is that the football competition of the Olympics took its place for a while until the idea came back again in the late 1920s.
Fascinating. And I mean, just as kind of as a more general question about this period, with the spread of football, like how does colonialism fit into that? And that's a question that was submitted on Instagram by Idle Vignette.
Yeah, it's a good question. It's a big question because obviously patterns of colonialism are kind of really important for understanding the way in which sport diffuses and spreads throughout the world in terms of lots of different imperial powers. And it's certainly important for understanding, for instance, you know, sports like cricket and rugby and why certain parts of the world play those sports. Football's a slightly more complex one because we have to look at the informal empire as well as the formal empire. So if we connect this up with the way in which the World Cup develops, the kind of two big blocks in the World Cup, certainly early on, are Europe and South America. And the spread of football to South America tends not to be through the formal empire, but through kind of trade and business links from the British, but not just the British. I mean, the British were very important in terms of railways and things like that. And so there were significant British communities in places like Buenos Aires and elsewhere, but others as well. The Italian community in parts of South America, Germans were very important in the kind of founding of clubs in various parts of South America. So it's kind of a complex pattern. I think colonialism kind of tells us something. And then when we get later in the 20th century and look at the rise of, for instance, the French-speaking African nations, a lot of that is explained by the significance of football as a form of education, but also in its promotion by missionaries. But early on, I think, you know, we have to recognise that actually colonialism is an aspect of it, but there are all sorts of networks that are emerging in the late 19th and early 20th century, which are allowing cultural practices such as football to develop and spread.
Yeah, indeed. And you mentioned the Olympics. I mean, how do we get from those Olympic football finals to then the first World Cup in 1930? What's that process?
It takes a bit of time, but it really is kind of linked to the fact that they become in the 1920s very, very popular, those football tournaments, partly because there is no, you know, there's no other competition. They become, as nations are getting better at football, are playing more, it becomes much more competitive. So the early Olympic tournaments, which are kind of serious, I suppose, in 1908 and 1912, Great Britain teams win it, kind of amateur teams entirely, and the question of amateurism and professionalism is an important factor. But then when we get to the 1920s, when Uruguay play in their first tournament in 1924, they're just incredible. Yeah. They're just very good. And the quality of the Uruguayan side really impresses. It takes place in Paris. So the French journalists are completely, bowled over by the how good the Uruguayans are. Something like kind of 60,000, I think, go to the final against Switzerland. And then 4 years later in Amsterdam. I think there's a great statistic which indicates that there's two matches take place. I think there's a replay that happened quite often. And then the second match between Uruguay and Argentina, apparently something like a quarter of the male population of the Netherlands applied for tickets. So it's, you know, so this was clearly incredibly popular, and FIFA recognised this. And so there were some conflicts over definitions of amateurism, and the British Football Associations had kind of, you know, stepped outside FIFA and weren't interested in the Olympic tournaments, because they thought, well, lots of the teams that were competing were kind of professionals. And so FIFA just decided, well, let's just create our own tournament, which is entirely independent of the Olympics.
And yeah, and it's held in Uruguay, and it's won by Uruguay. I mean, why were they such a special team then?
I think a number of factors. I think they're a talented team. They are... We could get to debates about the teams that don't attend, like the British teams, but they're probably the best team in the world through the 20s and, you know, into the early 30s. Lots of really good players who kind of years later also go on to play in Europe. So that kind of link is beginning early on. They described, I mean, I mentioned this finally in 1924, they're described in a great phrase by the French journalist Gabriel Hano, as he says, like, these Uruguayan players are like Arab thoroughbreds compared to the farm horses of the English. Now, the English aren't playing in that final. Yeah. They're not even playing. But Hano is kind of thinking about the English, particularly, who kind of consider themselves the best in the world. And he said, these are different sorts of players, incredible skill, incredible kind of elegance in the way that they play. They also have some star players, such as Andrade. Now, Andrade was one of the first black players to play. Uruguay had black players in its team from the first Copa America in 1916. And so he becomes a kind of important symbol of the nation, but also of a nation which is possibly more diverse in its approach to it, to various communities. And so I think that's all an important factor. But I also think the example of Uruguay in 1930 is the first really clear sign in this kind of major tournament of a nation connecting football to a kind of notion of national identity. Uruguay is a small nation. It's not known, particularly in Europe, particularly well. And football is its means of portraying a positive idea of the nation. And that's incredibly powerful in terms of Uruguay in this period, in the 20s and 30s.
Yeah, and I've got a question here from Martin Jones on Twitter, and I think you know him personally, which is, would any of the British teams have won it if they'd bothered to enter in the 1930s?
Yeah, so Martin Jones' question, it's a great question, and it's very difficult to answer, kind of counterfactual history. I think my answer would be possibly, but probably not. And the reason I say that is that the reason they didn't enter is because they weren't members of FIFA, and at the time there wasn't a great deal of coverage, you know, in the British press of these tournaments, which were seen as fairly marginal affairs. I think one of the reasons why they probably wouldn't have won one of these tournaments is the British teams were fairly good at playing at home, but they weren't very good travellers. The English, who tended to actually play more particularly in continental Europe in the 1930s, I think they ended up playing about 20 matches throughout that decade. They lost a fair proportion of those. I think they lost 7 or 8 of those matches, including against some of the best teams in Europe. So they would win at home famous matches in 1932, when they beat the Austrian Wunder team at home. They beat the Italians, who were the World Cup champions, at Highbury in 1934. But in early 1934, they lost away, before the World Cup in Italy, they lost away at Hungary and Czechoslovakia. So they lost a fair number of games. The selection for the British sides tended to not be very consistent, so different players would be picked for different games, and so a lot of players who played in these matches, you know, you'd have a match, a kind of big international match, and a number of players were playing their first game for England, so they weren't necessarily very experienced. I would say, however, if we think about a team that would possibly have won, it wouldn't necessarily have been England. Wales were very strong. in the 1930s. They won a number of the home international championships and extremely competitive in their matches against England and Scotland. However, again, we had the issue that they just didn't travel. I think their first match away in continental Europe was in 1931 against France. So they just didn't have the experience of playing away from home soil.
Yeah, fascinating. And I've got a question here from Tommy O'Mac on Instagram, which is, what was Mussolini's role at the 1934 World Cup? And this is the World Cup, it's held in Italy, isn't it?
Yeah. It's an interesting one because I think historians who have kind of worked closely on this, and kind of Italian historians and those who are working on, you know, the archives and things like that, kind of slowly uncovering this. It was very important for the fascist party. It's sometimes seen as Mussolini's World Cup because he kind of recognised its significance. I talked earlier about how significant the World Cup was seen for the projection of the Uruguayan nation. You know, Mussolini realised how significant putting on this World Cup was and showing that Italy was a modern, progressive in certain respects nation, which could put on an event like this in a range of stadia across Italy, because in Uruguay, the first World Cup just took place in one city, in Montevideo. So this took place throughout Italy, and some very new stadia which were built specially for the event, and a kind of very welcoming approach to the international media and things like that. So I think he recognised how significant this could be, both in Italy and abroad, in terms of projecting the notion of the Italian nation. Then there are questions around the selection of referees, the question of possible fixing of matches, which I think is far too complicated to go into. But there were certainly cases where I think, let's just say, lots of people involved in the World Cup, from the officials of the Italian officials who organised it, to the referees, to the Italian players, were aware that Mussolini very much wanted Italy to win this World Cup. And there was pressure on them, I think. And there are some interesting evidence been found about the possible pressure particularly put on particular referees during certain matches. So clearly he was involved, and he saw that it was significant and it was very important for fascist Italy.
Yeah. I mean, in a similar vein then, the 1930s is obviously marked by the rise of Nazi Germany. The 1938 tournament's held in France. How had the rise of Nazism affected the game by then?
Well, I think the main impact on the World Cup and on leading international football was the fact that after the Anschluss, the Austrian team was obviously merged into a greater German nation and became part of the German side. Now, that was significant, obviously, for all sorts of human reasons, but it was significant in kind of sporting terms because Austria were one of the teams of the 1930s. So I mentioned the kind of Wunder team of the early 1930s. They still had lots of really good players, very competitive, probably a better team than Germany around about that time. And so it was a key moment where the idea was that the German side would include a kind of mixture of Austrian and German players. So I think in the first match, there were 5 Austrian, 6 Germans, but some key figures didn't play. Matthias Sindelar, who was probably the most famous member of that Austrian team, just refused to play for a team representing Nazi Germany and didn't, play international football ever again. And so, yeah, that did have a significant impact. I think Germany weren't strong enough at this point to win the tournament, so it wasn't going to have that much of an impact in that sense. But I think that was important as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And of course, the World Cup doesn't take place again until 1950. It's held in Brazil. Uruguay win again. By now, who were the dominant teams in the 50s then, after the war?
Well, I would have to mention Uruguay. And the reason I'd mention Uruguay just to start off with is that their record, by 50 was quite extraordinary, because they kind of played in 30 and hadn't played in the next 2 World Cups, and then played in 50. So it's pretty much 100% record. So they would have been considered a very strong side, and they continued to be strong in the 50s. But I think there was another team that never won the World Cup who were probably the strongest team in the 1950s, and that was Hungary, the so-called kind of golden team, or the magnificent Magyars, the various kind of terms that are used. Their records is incredible. It's something like, I think from 1950 to 56, they're unbeaten except in one match, which is the 1954 World Cup final. And in amongst that, they beat some of the best teams in the world. They become Olympic champions because they're theoretically kind of amateur players. They have these very, very famous victories that the British football will know over England in Wembley in 1953 when they win 6-3 and kind of absolutely, completely dazzle the watching English journalists, but also kind of players who are watching and kind of really send a signal to the rest of the world. Even more important was the next year, they beat England 7-1 at home. This was no fluke. This was an incredible side who clearly were playing a brand of football which was far beyond what the masters of football, in inverted commas, were able to produce. It was an incredible side, but it was just extraordinary in a sense again that in this upset in Switzerland in 1954. All these games have got these great names linked to them. The Miracle of Bern, this is called. It was a game that the West Germans were never going to win, supposedly. Not a bad side, but Hungarians had got this incredible record and scored lots and lots of goals in the group matches and were on a sodden pitch. A bit of, slightly unlucky, slight poor performance from a couple of players. They lost the one match amongst 50 or 60 in that period. But they were an incredible team. And I think they're still, from the people who do this sort of statistical analysis, which is not what I do, I think they're still regarded, that Hungarian team of that period, probably as the best international team of all time.
Yeah, and I want to go back to sort of specifically the 1950 World Cup. There's a famous 1-0 defeat of England by the USA, isn't there? Was that seen as a huge upset at the time?
That's an interesting one because it is one of these cases, and I think you get this a lot in football as you do in other sports and in other, in other things as well, where the legend of it is almost more, that becomes the kind of mythical element of, the impact this event had. It was a shock. Unquestionably, it was a shock because England went to Brazil as one of the favourites. They'd not played in a World Cup before, but even so, they were still recognised as one of the best sides in the world. Up to this point, hadn't lost at home, very, very strong, and had actually been very strong during the 1940s. It's difficult to make a judgment in the war years, but a very strong English team during the war. And they were playing against USA, who were considered not to be a nation who played football, and so that what it was a surprise that they lost, and there was quite a lot of acrimony from parts of the popular press in England, but only for a short time, I would say. In some ways, the reaction was fairly muted, partly because international football probably still didn't mean a great deal in Britain generally and England specifically at that time. We hadn't got to a point where everyone followed very closely the fortunes of the national team and were glued to a radio or later a television to watch how they did. So the domestic game very much dominated things. So yeah, it was a shock, but it probably didn't matter to a great number of people. A few years later, the Hungarian defeat probably made people realise that we probably aren't the best in the world. So if we want to do something about this, we perhaps need to rethink certain aspects of the game. But it didn't really change for many years the fact that domestic football in Britain generally did dominate, I think.
Sure. I mean, what's interesting also about the 1950 tournament as well is there wasn't actually like a proper final, was there?
No, it was this. I think people still talk about that final game as the final. It was effectively the final, no. But I mean, what the Brazilian organisers, as far as I understand it, decided to do was to kind of maximise revenue in the second round by having a kind of round robin, a kind of group in the second round. So they had kind of more games rather than just a knockout competition. And what happened was the Brazilian side were very successful in their games. Uruguay were good as well, but I think they drew one of those. So we came to the final match, which was effectively the final, but the Brazilians could afford to draw that match and they'd have won the World Cup. So in that sense, it wasn't quite the same as a conventional final, because they'd have won on points if they'd have drawn the match. And to everyone's surprise, they didn't do so. And this perhaps is a case where the legend is justified, because the impact of that match was very significant, I think, on individuals and on a sense of the kind of Brazilian national psyche, because there was very much an expectation that Brazil were one of the best sides of the world. They would kind of, again, show where they'd reached as a nation and their kind of, that they were very much a modern nation, and football was a way of doing that. And it was incredibly surprising to people that they didn't win. They went 1-0 up in the match and conceded goals towards the end. And it had an incredible impact. This was played in the Maracanã Stadium, which was this great stadium, biggest stadium in the world. But it meant that, you know, certain things, the Brazilian side also played, I mean, we recognise them now as playing in their yellow kit. They played in white. After this match, they never played in white again. So, you know, it kind of was almost a refresh after that. And the World Cup still became the goal that Brazilians would kind of aim for, even more so. But it's kind of regarded as this kind of the fateful final in Brazil, kind of a really significant moment, as I say, in the national psyche.
Yeah, I think it's been described as like the nation's greatest tragedy or something.
That's right, yeah.
Yeah, quite unbelievable. I've got a very general question about this post-war period, which is, you know, how had football tactics and formations changed by this time? And, you know, how different were they to today?
Well, I think tactics had developed over time. I mean, if we talk firstly about tactics and the approach to the game, I think what had happened over time, and we'd kind of got there certainly, I think, by the late 50s and early 60s, is preparation and more kind of professional, in inverted commas, kind of preparation to football had developed and emerged. And again, it certainly wasn't the British who were at the forefront of this, that you have to prepare for a major tournament, for instance. You have to kind of get players together. You have to work on what people eat, you know, how you train people individually. Those sorts of things were being very seriously considered by countries like Brazil, who are at the forefront of that, by the Hungarians, who are, you know, in the very successful countries. So I think that element of preparation was very important. Tactically, what we'd moved from, I think, is a game which was much more based on attacking football early on, certainly in the early World Cups. I mean, probably the best example of this, if people know the book, a really good book by Jonathan Wilson called Inverting the Pyramid, which basically, so if you think of the formation of a football team as a pyramid, a 2-3-5 formation was the traditional way of teams organising. And over time, his argument is that became inverted and there was a move towards more defensive football. But this took place in stages. And so you had what was called the kind of WM formation, which would be kind of popular and towards the later part of the 30s, but still popular in Britain after the war, where you'd basically remove the inside forwards and they'd come back a little bit, and some of the defenders would kind of move up as well to kind of form almost a four in midfield. So those kind of things were developing over time. And I think the Hungarians, as I mentioned before, were at the forefront of a lot of this. I mean, one of their kind of key initiatives was, I mean, we might call it now the false nine, but certainly the kind of deep-lying, a kind of deep-lying centre-forward. Hidakuti played that role. And part of the reason for that was you had traditional, often big, strong centre-forwards, and teams were getting very good at marking these players. And so how do you get space? And one way you can get space is just kind of pull the forward further back onto the pitch, and that they would then gain space, make it difficult for the centre-backs, not knowing who to pick up and things like that. And that was one of the things that was key for the Hungarians. But another thing was that they played a very fluid form of football. Formations had previously been a lot more rigid. You know, players had stuck to where they were meant to be playing. But the Hungarians certainly adopted a form of football where actually players like Puskas and others, you know, were allowed to roam a fair amount. A kind of early form of total football, which was then developed further by the Netherlands team in the 1970s.
Yeah, and we'll come to total football in just a bit. But I want to jump now to the 1962 World Cup, which is held in Chile. And that's memorable for quite a violent game known as the Battle of Santiago. Can you just describe what that was?
Yeah, so very interesting moment and one that people will often associate with the World Cup. It had its origins in a visit, actually, by a delegation of Italian journalists to Chile, I think kind of a year or slightly more than a year before the World Cup. And the journalists were very critical of aspects of the preparation of the World Cup. They didn't think that, you know, the Chileans were ready for it in terms of the construction of the stadium. But the criticism went much beyond that. You know, they went to various parts of Santiago and parts of Chile and, you know, were critical of the living conditions of people living in shanty towns, even to the extent that they were kind of commenting on allegedly how unattractive the Chilean women were. So incredibly insulting, reports which came out in the Italian press, and not surprisingly were then reprinted in Chile. And so that kind of laid the basis for a very tense atmosphere, because the two teams were playing in a group match, and the atmosphere was terrible from the start. There was unrest in the crowd. The crowd were throwing stones and food and obviously insults at the Italian players, and it led to violence on the pitch. So Italian player Giorgio Farini was sent off, but then refused to leave the pitch, and the English referee Ken Aston probably hadn't experienced this in a refereeing in the Football League, didn't know what to do. Then there was a very famous kind of, you know, basically a straight-up fight between one of the Italian and Chilean players. The Italian guy was sent off, the Chile player wasn't. But it had just got completely out of hand, and the referee had lost control. And he got to the point where the police were kind of escorting the two Italian players who had been sent off the pitch. So, and this was also, by 62, the reports of this and later the images of it kind of were spread around the world. So the BBC, for instance, kind of said, you know, what an disgraceful, disgraceful behaviour. This is kind of completely unacceptable in a tournament which is supposedly a kind of showcase for the beautiful game, these sorts of things. So yeah, that was incredibly significant, and then had a knock-on effect, not surprisingly, to a degree on relations between, you know, Italian communities in Chile. You know, so there was quite a lot of unrest for a few years on the basis of that. So yeah, so that was, you know, very infamous and quite important.
Yeah, and it's funny you mentioned Ken Aston there, because isn't he the referee that invented red and yellow cards?
Yeah, I mean, this was possibly one of the things which might have given him the idea. But also, I suppose, in 4 years later, in 66, the famous moment when the match when England played Argentina and Ratin didn't leave the pitch. So again, it was when he was sent off, and there were supposed to be communication problems and things like that. He then came across the idea of, actually, let's have a symbol that everyone will understand, whatever language people speak, you know, a red and yellow card, and that will be a lot clearer, and players will know when they have to leave the pitch. So yes, his experiences in 62, he wasn't refereeing in 66, but he was kind of in charge of the referees, led Aston to come up with this idea.
Still to come on the History Extra podcast.
Certainly within Scotland, but not just in Scotland, the Scots were highly fancied. There was a feeling that, you know, possibly with a bit of luck and the wind behind the sails, that they could go far, possibly win it.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This episode is brought to you by Amazon Prime. You know Amazon Prime is not just a shipping subscription, right? It's got everything, including streaming TV and movies on Prime Video. And of course, Prime's fast, free shipping. Go from watching your favorite shows to getting your favorite things. Whatever you're into, it's on Prime. Visit Amazon.com/Prime to get more out of whatever you're into.
Now, I've got a question here from Ali Louisa on Instagram, and I think this is a reference to 66, but the question is, has the World Cup trophy ever been stolen?
Oh, yeah. So maybe we're talking about pickles here.
Yeah.
although it's not the only example. So, yeah, it is, I suppose, still one of the lists of key things that people know about the 1966 World Cup, both in the UK and elsewhere. So, yeah, the World Cup, the Jules Rimet Trophy, which was the cup at the time, not the current one, was being exhibited, I think, at Westminster Central Hall, and it was stolen and found, I think, around about a week later, kind of at the bottom of someone's garden in part of South London, by we never remember the person the person who owned the dog, but by a dog called Pickles, who then became a kind of global celebrity in a sense. So yeah, that was one of the key moments. It was, however, the Jules Rimet Trophy. 4 years later, when Brazil won their third World Cup, they got to keep the Jules Rimet Trophy. So from 1974, there was a new trophy, the World Cup Trophy, which is now the one we have. Although I think pretty much it's always replicas that we see, and the actual trophy is kept hidden away. But obviously the Jules Rimet Trophy then became the property of the Brazilian Federation. And so it was kept by the Brazilian Federation until it was stolen.
Yeah, it's melted down, wasn't it? Or something?
Yeah, people think it was melted down, stolen in 1983 and supposedly melted down. And so, yeah, so it was stolen twice. And second time, never found. There was no Brazilian pickles to find it.
No Brazilian pickles. Brilliant. So, yeah, with apologies to non-England fans, talking about the World Cup in 1966, I mean, why was that so special? I mean, obviously for England fans, it's always going to be special. But was there anything about the way it was marketed and like the TV coverage?
I think there were some interesting things about aspects of the television coverage. It was the first World Cup, which was included matches which were kind of broadcast by satellite to other parts of the world, particularly through the European agreements through Eurovision to parts of continental Europe, but also Mexico. In Mexico, you know, a number of the matches were shown live, for instance, which was quite interesting and quite important. In terms of the marketing and the aspects linked to that, you had the arrival of one of the first World Cup mascots, and actually one of the first mascots in related to any sporting event to extent, kind of well known perhaps in England, World Cup Willie, the kind of comical lion who was kind of adorned a lot of, you know, the programmes and various other aspects as well. So, and also it kind of led to a song which was sung by Lonnie Donegan, which did well in the charts, about World Cup Willie. So you know, there were these elements which were then followed later, which were you know, established first during the kind of marketing of the 66 World Cup.
And then we come to 1970, and it's really famous for that Brazil team, which are considered like the greatest team ever, aren't they? Why did they resonate with so many people?
Yeah, I mean, at the heart of it is the fact that they were incredibly good and incredibly talented and played a form of football which seemed uninhibited. So I think although, you know, that without that, other things wouldn't have happened. But it coincided with a number of other things as well. This was a World Cup, which again, there were developments in broadcasting. So the 66 World Cup, you know, generally took place in black and white. A lot of people, not everyone, but a lot of people who had colour television would have witnessed the 70 World Cup in colour. And so the glamour associated with the Brazilian team in their, you know, bright bright kits. And so that's an important aspect of it. But I think a third really significant factor is that they resonated. It kind of links in a way to colour and race. The black players in the Brazilian side certainly resonated in Brazil, but elsewhere as well in the world, in parts of Africa, certainly, but in parts of Europe, amongst black communities in Europe, there's lots of evidence that they were really, really popular and kind of became kind of idols or role models. I've got a student who's working on the emergence of black players in Ireland, and he's found, you know, evidence from really significant players like Paul McGraw and others who write in their autobiographies. You know, it was the Brazilian side of the 70s which really showed me that I could do it. You know, these were people who looked like me, and these were people who really meant something to me. So I think the Brazilian side of 1970 was kind of global in that sense, in a way that no World Cup winning side before was.
Yeah, and of course it was the third time they'd won it as well.
Yeah, of course. So they'd already been recognised as a quality side, and Pelé, who had emerged in 58 as a young 17-year-old, by this point was the established kind of star of world football. So he was a symbol of that, but it was a great team beyond that. It was 11 very good players.
Yeah, and now talking about iconic World Cup squads, we've got to talk about the Netherlands team of 1974, you know, the team of Johan Cruyff. Were they one of the best teams not to win it?
Yeah, again, kind of difficult to do the counterfactual history, but I think we'd probably say, yeah, along with the Austrian team of the 30s and the Hungarians of the 50s, yeah, we definitely have to say the Netherlands team of the 70s, particularly 74. And again, it wasn't just about their quality as a team, which of course they had. It was a number of things. I think we have to remember, because of course now the Netherlands are an established kind of leading team in world football. In the 70s, they weren't. I mean, you had a very strong Ajax team, so people knew the players if they were interested in football. But Netherlands did not have a pedigree in the World Cup. They played a couple of times in the 1930s, but they'd not figured before this. And so there was a kind of exoticism, I think, associated with them. And then also it was kind of linked to the colour, the fact that the team played in orange and the fans could be seen because they were in this incredible... So that was that kind of aspect of things. And then also there was the way they played football. Similarly to the Hungarians, this kind of progression of this notion of total football, which had been developed by Rinus Michels and people like Cruyff and Niskins and Rep and others, really, really kind of developed that in the national team and also in their club side. So I think that was important. But also the players very much, I think, we might compare them with the West German team, you know, who won the World Cup in 74, who generally were considered quite, and I'm avoiding kind of too many kind of national stereotypes, but were considered very, at this point, relatively conservative, relatively, you know, disciplined, whereas the Dutch team was considered much more relaxed, kind of some, they had slightly longer hair. You know, they'd not experienced a tournament like this before. So, for instance, they enjoyed themselves, and it was kind of known that they were enjoying themselves during the time. So they were kind of a much more modern representation of youth in the 1970s.
Absolutely. Now, I want to talk a bit about Argentina's role in the World Cup. They host the tournament in 1978, don't they? Again, just for context, why is that so controversial?
Well, I mean, I think 78 is one of a number of examples you have where the choice of the host nation becomes a controversial choice because of the political nature of the nation. Argentina at the time was ruled by the military junta, and there were all sorts of human rights issues which were known about in across the world and in the media in various parts of the world. So what you do have in Argentina is quite a significant campaign which is organised by human rights groups and, you know, some political groups. But I think we shouldn't dismiss it as a narrow thing. It was very significant. It was based in France, and so there were something like 200 local organisations which were kind of pushing to convince the nations in the World Cup to either boycott the World Cup or to change the venue of the World Cup to somewhere else, or at the very least to make sure the issues were much more widely known across the world. And so That was a really key moment in 78, probably the first example where that really becomes significant in the World Cup. Obviously, it kind of was then replicated in the Olympics at other times as well. So in the end, all the teams did attend, apart from, you know, a couple of the Dutch players didn't.
Yeah, Cruyff doesn't go, does he?
Cruyff didn't go, no.
No. I mean, talking about Argentina, Maradona doesn't make his World Cup debut till 82 in Spain, does he? But I think for England fans, it's his appearance in 1986 in Mexico that's memorable for certain reasons. What impact did that hand of God goal have?
Yeah, again, it's one of these things which, you know, the memory of it may be different to how it was received at the time. I mean, clearly there were lots of people and developments of the press who weren't happy, who regarded him as, you know, simply a cheat. This is a player who's cheated us, and the popular press said this very clearly. I think the Sun had a headline, or I think we effectively, you know, said this person's a cheat. But then other newspapers such as the Daily Express had a headline which said genius cheat. Because his first goal, it was considered completely unacceptable, completely, you know, lack of sportsmanship, un-British in inverted commas, whereas the second goal was, you know, remembered as the goal of the century, and this incredible dribble through the whole England team. And I think, though, that range of reactions probably did exist amongst people more broadly as well. And we've got a little bit of a hint of this, actually, because the social search organisation Mass Observation, which had kind of its kind of revised version in the 80s, did ask people about, you know, their reactions to this World Cup, and it asked people a few decades later also about, you know, what were your memories of the World Cup. And I think what you find is that people's reactions were quite varied and often quite reasonable. We got beaten, but then again, this happens in sport. You know, people do what they can sometimes to win matches. We suffered because of this, but then, you know, we might be on the winning end of this at another time. Of course, alongside that, there is an element of hatred. There are expressions of xenophobia as well in those things occasionally. But I think it's much more measured than we might think, actually, and much more measured than perhaps we're told by the press and others now.
Yeah, because it's not that long after the Falklands War, is it? So,
yeah, it's not. I mean, the 82 was the one which was kind of immediately after, but 86, it was still very much in the public memory. So I think when it becomes clear England are going to play Argentina, I think the Sun says, you know, bring on the RGs, and, you know, stokes up the military metaphor and things like that, which is, so of course, so beloved of the tabloid press, to a certain extent it still is, and which, you know, many other countries kind of didn't understand, but, you know, I didn't kind of realise why there was this focus. But yeah, it was in the recent memory, so it was a factor. But I think what you find then is, when England play Argentina in 1998, there's some of that still, but it's not any. I don't think it's quite as strong as we expect it to be, and I think the reaction is rather more measured, and kind of people are prepared to understand that alongside a different attitude to football and a different kind of cultural view of football, and the fact that in Argentina, Maradona's action was regarded as just, you know, very clever and very tricky, you know, we don't see things necessarily in that way. And that, you know, that expresses just how incredible football is, that we recognise different actions in different ways.
Yeah, and now we've talked about England quite a lot, but Scotland also qualified for five consecutive finals between 1974 and 1990, didn't they? What was the reason for their success in this golden age?
Oh, they had some very good players. I think there's no question about that. You know, I think we're talking at a time in the 70s through to the 80s when, slightly differently from now, I suppose, where you've got so many players from, you know, across the world in the top divisions in England, where some of the top players in English football were Scots. And actually, they had been for many decades. So some really, I mean, Kenny Dalglish is one of many examples. But, you know, every team had a number of excellent Scottish players. So there were great players who didn't, you know, even make the Scottish national team. So I think that's a factor. And I think you need to remember that in one of those tournaments in 1978, certainly within Scotland, but not just in Scotland, the Scots were highly fancied. There was a feeling that, you know, possibly with the with a bit of luck and the wind behind the sails, that they could go far, possibly win it. And you had the Ali McLeod who said they could win the World Cup, which is now mentioned all the time. But I think that's important because they did have a great side and they did perform, at least in one game, extremely well, but they had a disappointing match in the others, a famous game against the Netherlands, of course, one of the best teams in the world, and the famous goal by Archie Gemmell that a lot of people remember. But it also came at around about a time of kind of where there was a national referendum in Scotland, so there was an increasing focus on the nation and kind of football as an emblem of the nation. And so I think that's a factor there as well, that around about that time, Scotland again becomes seen on the world stage through international football tournaments, and it happens, as you say, five times in a row, and it's really important. The football team being there, but also, the supporting fans who develop their own kind of culture of supporting the national team, which they almost develop in contrast to the kind of hooliganism which is associated with the English football followers. And so that becomes a marker of kind of, how certainly Scots see themselves on the international stage and how they want others to see them as well.
Now let's talk about the Americans, USA 94. Does that change their perceptions of the beautiful game? I mean, I suppose this is tied to a question I've got here from Denise Davidson, which is, why was football so slow to catch on in America?
Yeah, so I mean, I think it's an interesting question. And I'm not sure the answer is that straightforward. I think it's, on the face of it, I think you might say that it didn't change a great deal. Soccer didn't suddenly kind of emerge and find its way alongside the big four sports, alongside baseball or American football or even basketball after 1994. So it certainly didn't do that. But I think probably its impact was slightly more subtle than that. I think, there's an argument that the more recent development of Major League Soccer and more generally kind of soccer amongst women as well. I mean, we might talk about the US women's team. But a lot of that might be linked to people's enthusiasm as kind of young boys and girls, watching the 94 World Cup in the US. It certainly never pushed into the mainstream, but it probably didn't need to. I mean, the historian Joshua Nadel has kind of argued that actually one of its big impacts was on particular elements of US society, so particularly on the way in which Latinos were seen in the US. And that led to a kind of more nuanced treatment of Latinos and actually a way of kind of bringing Latino culture into the mainstream, because there was a lot of support amongst those sorts of, that element of American society. And so perhaps the impact is more subtle. The World Cup didn't completely change the nature of American sport. And I don't think it ever could have done. But I think it probably had an impact in a more subtle way amongst particular elements of US society and over a longer period of time.
Yeah, and briefly there, you mentioned the women's game. I mean, the 1990s sees the start of the Women's World Cup, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, you had the development of the official World Cup in the 90s. Of course, as there were with the Men's World Cup, there were tournaments before that. So there were unofficial tournaments, in the early 70s, kind of famous World Cup in Mexico and other events in Italy. And actually, if we're thinking about women's international football, we can go back a lot further. We can go back to the 1920s where the Dick Kerr ladies team played against a French side, and that effectively was branded as an international match between England and France. But yeah, you do have the emergence of a recognisable kind of World Cup in the 90s. And even to the point where I think the particularly the 1999 World Cup, which again was in the US, was really important. A key moment. The attendances were massive. I think you had an average of 37,000 attendance in the final, over 90,000. And a lot of the games were played in general sports stadiums, so in American football stadia and places like that. So this again was a case where football kind of pushed beyond its kind of relatively niche place in American society and became more mainstream. And you had kind of iconic images, particularly, I think, Brandy Chastain's celebration after the winning penalty in the final against China. So I think all those factors kind of link together. And I think it's helpful in the US, actually, to see those two competitions together rather than separating them. I think 94, the 94 Men's World Cup and the 99 Women's World Cup both had an impact. Although, you know, sometimes it took a while for it to really reach fruition and for it to really be recognised. But I think they were both important for popularising and, in some ways, you might, it's a bit of an ugly phrase, but kind of mainstreaming to a degree soccer in the US.
Now, I've got a few general questions here. I've got one here from Tom Nolan on Twitter, which is, I'm concerned about the expansion of the World Cup to 48 teams from 2026. How have changes to the format been received in the past?
Yeah, it's a difficult one because behind expansion is almost always, you know, the question of satisfying different groups within what FIFA call the FIFA family, within the various nations who are represented. And, you know, obviously the World Cup has expanded significantly over time. I mean, a couple of examples, you know, which are probably significant. 1982 was the time when it was expanded to 24 teams. And that was very much part of the FIFA president, Joe Havelange's campaign, really. He campaigned to become president in 1974 on the basis that that was what he would do. You know, that he would open up the World Cup, the premier competition, to more of the African and Asian countries, and that the confederations in those parts of the world would be represented more. And so obviously that expansion was popular very much in those parts of the world. There was more concern. It was less popular in perhaps in the established parts of world football, where there was a fear that, you know, okay, we'll open this up and we'll have teams like as appeared in 82 Kuwait. You hadn't appeared before, kind of Honduras, El Salvador, you know, who will absolutely get, you know, brushed aside and will not be competitive. But that didn't really happen. I mean, El Salvador were hammered in one of their games against Hungary, I think it was. But actually, they did quite well. Cameroon, for instance, who played in that World Cup, didn't get through the group round, but they didn't lose a game, including drawing against Italy, who won the World Cup. And then Cameroon then really developed into one of the, you know, kind of well-known, I suppose, World Cup nations. And that was also the World Cup where Algeria famously beat West Germany 2-1 and would have gone through the group if it wasn't for a kind of disgraceful kind of fixed game between Austria and West Germany, because they knew, you know, that the Germans scored and they knew that they would both go through, because at that time the final matches in the group didn't take place at the same time. So they already knew that, you know, they would go through. So you actually had the fear of what might happen by broadening the competition, I think, was very quickly challenged, I think, by what happened. A similar case in 1998, there was an expansion there from 24 to 32. The interesting thing about what happened in France in 1998 is that expansion was decided after the French had already started planning the tournament. So they kind of had to kind of make quick changes and kind of accept that this was a bigger... But again, the motivation was to open up. There was a, you know, to open up the Premier Tournament to a bigger number of countries and many parts of the world where football was incredibly popular and where the game was increasingly being played to a pretty high standard. So I think by 98, there was less concern about the quality, perhaps, of the teams. But I think maybe the issue we have now is simply, you know, is it, you know, how long does this event go on? And, you know, is it, can we think of it really as an elite tournament if there are so many countries playing in it?
Yeah. And how have host nations been selected? Has that process changed a lot?
It's been relatively consistent in certain ways. I mean, a competitive kind of bidding process is generally how things have developed. You've tended not to have in the World Cup as many countries who have wanted to host as happened in the Olympics. And so certainly early on, you've got a case where there weren't really many options. I mean, Uruguay was the only real option for 30, 34. Italy was the only real nation who could put that on. So, it kind of has stayed fairly consistent. But then you have had quite a number of tensions and disagreements over that, because the next World Cup in 1938 in France did lead to quite a few disagreements. And a lot of that was based on the kind of rivalry between the two big blocks at the time, the South Americans, kind of Latin Americans, probably more accurately, and Europeans. Because there was a kind of assumption that the World Cup would alternate between those two parts of the world. It didn't happen in 1938. The Argentina bid for the World Cup and were well beaten by France, and they kind of were very unhappy about that because they had a better infrastructure, better stadia and things like this. And so because of that, the Uruguayans, who had supported them, decided not to come to Europe. You know, they just, well, we're not going to play a World Cup in Europe. The Argentinians didn't play. And that kind of process of effectively boycotting competitions did happen quite often. So yeah, it could be quite a fraught process, the choice of the host nation.
Yeah, I mean, that ties in very neatly with another question I've got here from Tom Nolan on Twitter, which is, how does Qatar 2022 compare with previous competitions in terms of the criticism levelled at FIFA and the organisers? I mean, we've talked about Argentina 78, haven't we?
Yeah, I mean, I think probably as a tournament like the World Cup does go to different parts of the world, I think these things do happen. And I think there have been many occasions. I mean, in many ways, you know, Qatar and the last World Cup in Russia, you know, we could look at together, because there have been and will continue to be all sorts of criticisms about the decision to choose those countries as host nations. But I think, just reminding us of the fact that this, you know, this has a history, and this has happened previously. I mean, I do think Argentina is probably, it's comparable to some of the criticisms with Qatar, but I think actually in what the organised nature of the campaign against kind of the anti-World Cup campaign, as it were, is actually kind of much more significant than has happened in recent years in terms of Russia and Qatar. So I think actually, you know, we have a precedent with these sorts of things, and, you know, it has happened before.
Now, this is more of a, I guess it's more of a personal question, but do you think the World Cup has lost some of its allure, or is it often a case of people's perceptions being coloured by nostalgia?
Yeah, I think nostalgia comes into this quite a lot. I mean, when my kind of image, when I think of the World Cup, is very much linked to some of my early experiences. So, for instance, when I immediately think of the World Cup, I think of, for me, you know, the first World Cups that I saw, so 1982 and Tardelli and his celebration, and the great Brazil team of Zico and Falcao and people like that. Of course, he didn't win. Another one of the teams, by the way, the great teams that didn't win the World Cup, Brazil in 1982. And I think of 86, and, you know, you've already mentioned the hand of God and things like that. And these are kind of, you know, emotional for me, and very much, you know, part of why I still love the World Cup and kind of international football. So, there's that. But of course, as we already talked about, that was a period where football itself wasn't at a high point in Britain, certainly. You know, in fact, it was kind of a fairly low point. And so our memories are affected by that nostalgia, and how kind of significant and how great the event was. But it probably wasn't. It probably wasn't as popular as we think it was. And actually, the World Cup probably is more popular than it was at that period. Now, there were other issues, kind of issues of corruption and things like this, and you know, the fact that as you say, kind of almost every tournament is affected now by criticisms of you know, of aspects of the choice of the host and the regime, and that it's right that we should consider those things. But I still think there are other things, like, you know, the fact that club football through the rise of the Champions League and things like that, people might suggest, well, that has it's there that the best football takes place. It's there that international football is really projected on a kind of world stage. And I think, although there's an element of that, I still think the World Cup continues to be important as something which is quite unique, a unique showcase. It is where you can see some of the best players in the world from lots of different parts of the world, kind of on a kind of global stage for a relatively short period. And it still surprises people, I think. So I think there's still something in the World Cup, but I think there's it faces challenges.
That was Professor Matthew Taylor of the International Centre for Sports History and Culture at De Montfort University. Thanks for listening to the History Extra podcast. This podcast was produced by Brittany Colley.